Hi guys, so today I'm going to talk about hemorrhagic shock. So I did do a podcast on hypovolemic shock. So you might be thinking, okay, what's the difference? It sounds the same. Not necessarily. So I'm going to kind of like distinguish the difference between the both of them and help you kind of understand it. So hypovolemia versus hemorrhagic shock. So let's kind of like compare them. Hemorrhagic shock is like the flowing of blood. It is a type of hypovolemic shock. So it's a classification, in other words. But this is exclusively blood. Remember, hypovolemia can be like third spacing, fluid shifting, like in burns. I always like to use that example. Or any type of like fluid volume loss, like vomiting and diarrhea. But hemorrhagic shock or hemorrhage is the flowing of blood, and it's a classification of hypovolemic shock, just to restate that. During hemorrhage, like a large amount of blood is lost, typically in a short period of time. Blood loss can be arterial, venous, or capillary. The seriousness depends on like the anatomical source of the hemorrhage, if it's arterial, if it's venous, if it's capillary, the degree of vascular disruption, and the amount of blood loss tolerated. So, if you remember, sorry, apparently my Siri thought that I was speaking to him. Anyways, I'm not going to delete the video over that. So, do you classify the hemorrhagic shock by capillary, slow, even flow, bright red color, venous, steady, slow flow, dark red color, arterial, spurting blood, pulsating flow, and bright red color. Now, what would you say is more serious? Capillary blood loss or arterial blood loss? Arterial, because you can lose blood at a faster rate. So let's go into some causes, which I mean can be kind of obvious, but causes of hemorrhage are trauma, which they can either be blunt or penetrating. So you can have blunt trauma to the back, and you take anatomy and physiology and what's located in the back, the lower back, your kidneys. So you can have blunt trauma to your kidneys and you can damage them and you could start bleeding. Or you can have blunt trauma to your abdomen and damage your spleen and start bleeding. So, or you can have a penetrating wound into your abdomen and lacerate your liver or lacerate your spleen. Medical can be a cause, acute or chronic medical illnesses. Vascular access devices like LVADs and dialysis shunts. Like that's kind of a little bit different. But mostly what you cover in paramedic school is trauma, which is blunt and penetrating, because that's what you come across most of the time on the job. So blunt and penetrating trauma. It can be internal or external. You can have a gunshot wound. So what would you classify that as? You can classify that as penetrating trauma because you're breaking tissue. Now, the damage is going to be mostly internal because the passageway, if you have an exit wound, if it comes out through the exit, it did all that damage on its way in and on its way out. So that's how you would classify something like that. So internal hemorrhage, I'm going to give you some examples. It can be found typically in one of these body cavities, the chest, the abdomen, the retroperitoneal space, which, if you know your anatomy, is the kidneys, which I just said, and your pelvis. It can also be out of the vagina, a spontaneous abortion, childbirth. So that's another classification, that's another like example of hemorrhagic shock, which is you can have postpartum hemorrhage after childbirth. So if you ever have a delivery in a rescue, that is something that can start to happen. I mean, I would say it depends where you work, how long it takes to go to the hospital. But that's something that you need to start having fluids on board, like, immediately, like, when all of this is happening, because, giving birth requires, pushing, and you push all this fluid out, and you're bleeding, and, you know, there's a lot of fluid and blood loss that's happening in birth. A spontaneous abortion, you know, something happens to a female at home and she notices that she's having a miscarriage, she can bleed too much, and she can have hemorrhaging. Out of the rectum, a GI bleed, a ruptured diverticulum, cancer. So your GI bleeds, when they have that melena, that dark, tarry, black stools, they're having bleeds. From the nose, a severe nosebleed, also known as epitaxis. This is a fancy name for it from your textbook. From a vascular access device, like I said, a dialysis shunt, an LVAD. Both traumatic, this is good to know, both traumatic and non-traumatic, internal hemorrhage is associated with higher morbidity and mortality than external hemorrhage. Why? Because you cannot see it. Remember in the hypovolemic shock podcast, I talked about relative and absolute hypovolemic shock. This would be a form of relative. You cannot see it. So these types of things tend to go kind of unnoticed, and they go concealed for a little while, and they don't get a treatment immediately, and the patient may not even notice, they, you know, that they're starting to bleed, or they might not understand, or whatever the case may be. And this is a lot less alarming than seeing, you know, blood out of the body, external. Traumatic causes of hemorrhage, which is really good for you guys to know, are like chest injuries, abdominal injuries, retroperitoneal injuries to the kidneys, vessels, femur fractures, bilateral in adults, single in kids, pelvic fractures. Each fracture can bleed 500 mLs of blood, which is something that I learned in paramedic school. Pelvic trauma usually causes from multiple fracture sites, which means that if you have pelvic trauma, look around because you have other broken bones. So closed head trauma, hemorrhage is another classification. Inside, closed, sealed inside the cranium, there's only enough space for the brain. The brain has a little bit of space there. If it starts to swell too much, you can have ICP. You can have leaking of cerebrospinal fluid from the ears, from the nose, blood that flows through the brain. A closed head injury cannot cause hemorrhagic shock. There is not enough space within the closed and sealed cranium to allow for hemorrhage. However, you may start to leak CSF from the ears and from the nose, and you can have increased ICP. Traumatic hemorrhage, you always suspect a significant mechanism of injury and multi-system trauma. So something you want to be thinking about is if you have a traumatic hemorrhage, your mechanism of injury was absolutely significant and you have multi-system trauma. So you never want to forget to stabilize that C-spine, because if other things are having issues and this was a trauma, you need to stabilize that C-spine. Do not get tunnel vision where you're like, oh my God, blood, blood, blood. I need to put pressure on the wound. I need to hang fluids. I need to do this. When you go through your lab testing, your first thing is BSI scene safety, and you want to initiate C-spine precautions first before you do anything, because any alteration in that patient may cause further damage before you get to the hospital, and we don't want to do that. So non-traumatic causes of hemorrhage, which are not as common, but when they are common, they can be pretty serious. GI bleeds, ruptured esophageal varices, ruptured ectopic pregnancy, dissecting ruptured aneurysms, AAA, thoracic, which is thoracic, ruptured diverticulum, colon cancer, lung cancer, and a spontaneous abortion, which is another word for a miscarriage. Signs and symptoms of internal hemorrhage. Remember, I was going to tell you guys how to study for these things. I've given you the classifications and the description. Now I'm going to give you the signs and symptoms. This is like just hitting the key points and hitting the high notes of what you need to know for your exams. So signs and symptoms of internal hemorrhage. So this is something that you can't see. It's happening internally, but some of these symptoms are going to be external. I want you to think about that. Hemoptysis, which is coughing up bright red blood from the lungs, has to be massive, as in like lung cancer or some type of trauma that's happening inside. Hematemesis, bear with me because I'm not great at pronouncing words, which is vomiting up red blood from the GI tract. Emesis, that looks like coffee grounds or dried cola. That's another sign of internal hemorrhage. Melena, like I mentioned earlier, which is your black, your tarry stools. Hematochezia, which is the passage of red blood through the rectum, pure blood. Dizziness or syncope when sitting and standing, and orthostatic hypotension. Now keep in mind those last two, dizziness or syncope when sitting, standing, or orthostatic hypotension, that can be present in other things, so that's not like a super specific symptom. So, hemorrhage classification: to stop bleeding via hemostasis, the body initially responds in phases: the vascular phase, the platelet phase, the coagulation phase, and the fibrous tissue growth phase. These are the phases that they're going to go through, and this is just kind of like the pathophysiology behind hemorrhagic shock. So vasoconstriction happens in the vascular phase. It's quick but temporary. Vessels constrict and retract. They try to slow blood loss, and they may completely close ends of the injured vessel. This lasts about 10 minutes. Think about this as your internal tourniquet. During this time, blood coagulation's mechanisms are like also activated to form a blood clot. So when you cut yourself on your skin, your blood starts to clot to prevent you from bleeding out. That's a defense that our body has, put in super simple terms. Your platelet phase, platelets adhere to injured blood vessels and to collagen. They become sticky and activate chemicals to attract other platelets. This creates a platelet plug. The plug can stop bleeding if the vessel wound is small. If it's large, a blood clot is necessary. Excuse me. Coagulation phase is a chemical process. Prothrombin activator forms in response to the damage. The prothrombin activator stimulates a conversion of prothrombin to thrombin. Thrombin converts fibrinogen into fibrin threads. Fibrin threads entrap platelets, blood cells, and plasma to form the clot. Fibrous tissue phase. Finally, this is a last phase. Fibrous tissue grows into the clot, and it permanently closes to try to heal the wound. So obviously in hemorrhagic shock, this does not happen because we need to control that wound. The body is going to try to do it, but we need to control it. So some of these things that might exist in your older patients that affect clotting are movement of the wound site, aggressive fluid therapy, increase of blood pressure displaces the clots. Something else that's kind of present in your older population was are like aspirin regimens, like people who have heart problems that take aspirin on a regular basis, people who are on Coumadin, which tend to be like have atrial fibrillation, and they're at risk for clots, and heparin. These three medications inhibit your clotting. They make your blood more liquidy because it's trying to prevent a clot from forming. So keep your patients warm because it's going to help them clot when their insides are trying to repair themselves, if that's like put super simply, but you get what I'm saying, on the way to the hospital, you want to keep them warm. So if bleeding is super severe, other factors affect clotting, hypovolemic shock then occurs. So as you can see, this is how they're related, but they're a little different. And the normal blood volume in adult is 4.5 to 5 liters. Remember, I talked about this in hypovolemic shock. So basically, this is the classification within hypovolemic shock. Hemorrhagic shock is just exclusive to blood flow outside of the body. So these are to like resuscitate these patients, you would have to hang 20 mLs per kilogram. You want to maintain your radial pulse. If you don't feel radial pulses, you're not having adequate tissue perfusion. You want to try to keep them normal tensive. The IV, like I said, it would be 20 mLs per kilogram. They may be hypotensive, but you want to make that blood pressure a little bit higher, and you want to keep checking your pulses and making sure and assessing your patient every 5 minutes, assessing their respirations, their O2 saturation, their blood pressure especially, and assessing their pulses. Like bilaterally, making sure that they have pulses, peripheral pulses, because that indicates whether there's good tissue perfusion. Looking at them, looking at their skin, are they having cyanosis? That's not good. Are they having trouble breathing? That might indicate a further problem. Are they sweating? Are they looking like they're on a slippery slope into the deeper manifestations of shock? So that's when you need to get more aggressive, which on a rescue, the only thing that you have to treat shock is fluids and time. Time being the least of it. You need to get to the hospital soon, as fast as possible. And you need to aggressively challenge this patient with fluids. Isotonic fluids, which I just spoke about in a prior podcast, and that you'll understand why when you hear me explain that. So those are the things that you need to do when handling somebody who has hemorrhagic shock, in addition to direct application of pressure. Don't just soak up the blood with like a bulky dressing. You need to add direct pressure to whatever is bleeding. Commercial tourniquets, hemostatic dressings, any type of resources that you have inside a rescue to be able to control that bleeding, which are typically like commercial tourniquets or any type of hemostatic dressings or direct pressure that you would apply manually. Direct pressure that you would apply manually, commercial tourniquets, hemostatic dressings, aggressive fluid management for the patient, and aggressive monitoring every 5 minutes. Treat them as a critical patient, even if they're just entering the signs, because they can become critical very quickly. So I want you to take away from this is that you have to monitor your patient, you have to watch them for manifestations of shock, and you have to watch them if they're decompensating quickly, because if they are, that's not a good sign. So the only thing to treat something like this would be blood products, which you don't have in a rescue. So that's why getting to the hospital soon is also priority, along the lines of fluid management and direct pressure to whatever wound that you can see that's causing the hemorrhaging, and making sure that you control that the best way that you can with the resources available to you in a rescue. So that was a little bit long-winded, but I hope you understand the idea. So that was it on hemorrhagic shock. Hopefully I clarified both of them to you, because they can become confusing, because one is a classification of the other and one kind of leads into the other. So hopefully that made you understand them a little bit better. Good luck, guys, on school, and have a good day.